Hiring isn't just about finding someone willing to take the job. You need the right person with the right background who can move your business forward. If you want candidates who truly match what you're looking for, trust Indeed Sponsored Jobs. With Indeed Sponsored Jobs, your post stands out to quality candidates who actually fit the role. According to Indeed data, 90% are more likely to be hired and trusted by 1.6 million companies. Spend more time interviewing candidates who check all your boxes. Less stress, less time, more results. Now with Indeed Sponsored Jobs. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to help your job get the premium status it deserves at Indeed.com/podcast13. Just go to Indeed.com/podcast13 right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/podcast13. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Do it the right way with Indeed.
Hello and what's up, everybody? It is the Wind Up Podcast this Wednesday, March 27th, and we are getting into our March question and answer episode. As is tradition, the last episode of every month, we dive into a handful of questions that we received out at the winery through our DMs, any comments to our videos, emails, whatever the case may be, so that we can kind of dive into them and help dispel whatever it is you all are interested in when it comes to the wine industry. Before we get too far into it, a couple of announcements. Number one, thank you all who have purchased tickets to our upcoming events. Actually, our events in both Dallas and Chicago are sold out. For those of you in the great state of Missouri or on the Kansas border near Kansas City, we still have room both in Kansas City as well as St. Louis, actually, for those wine tasting events this April. You can head to our website, mtjwines.com, click on the shop. You'll see the ticket information, the location, time, all that good stuff. We hope that you can make it if you're in that locale. For all of you that have been rating, reviewing, downloading, listening, again, can't thank you all enough. Please continue to do so. It's a huge help, especially if you get out there and you leave a little rating or review wherever it is you're consuming your podcast. It's a huge help to help with the algorithm and help this show kind of get out and about, make it easier for people to find as well. So thank you all so much who have jumped right in and taken care of that as well. Let's get into it, shall we? We have covered a lot of hot topics over the last month, and we've had a lot of questions as a result kind of lean into those between grape pricing and kind of the future of Napa, where it's heading, this whole consultant, and is terroir less and less of a factor when it comes to winemaking in Napa, and also some of these travel and events, like how that ends up happening, just kind of some more businessy type stuff as well. It's going to be a nice swath of, you know, information that's going on in this week's episode to answer some of these questions for you all. So without further ado, let's get into question number one, shall we? And I always have to remember to timestamp these so that when I'm editing this video, it's a little bit easier for me to track it down and make the cuts we need to. So, question one, what are the causes of Napa being slower in terms of business and tourism, as you've mentioned in recent shows? Is it a cause for concern? This is something that all of us are trying to figure out. And believe me, if I had a crystal ball, it would probably be really helpful right about now. Something that many of you might not realize about Napa is, or maybe it doesn't even just, it's you just kind of don't even think about it, is that it is a very tourism-driven industry between people visiting here, as you might expect. We're actually a lot of small towns with Napa sitting at like 75,000 people. There's maybe, I think, 100,000 people, a little over that, that live in Napa Valley, in the whole valley. So it's not a huge place, realistically. It's probably bigger than most kind of agricultural areas, I guess, that are kind of away from your major city hubs. But we rely very, very heavily on, of course, people visiting and tourism coming our way. And it kind of goes without saying, you know, at least in our minds for the most part, that you have ebbs and flows to this. You're going to have years like a 2021, which is just gangbusters. It's crazy, crazy busy. You're going to have years like maybe the latter half of 2022 or 2023 last year that are going to be a little bit slower. And these are just kind of the normal peaks and valleys of a tourism-driven industry. That's just kind of the long and short of it. There's really no two ways around it. You're going to have to be able to ride these waves out and just keep doing what you're doing and hopefully be a little bit creative to find ways to drive business towards yourself. Last year, I think it's left a lot of people reeling because you had folks that were down, you know, 10, 20, 30% in overall revenue and visitation. It put a lot of people on their heels. And I think that's something that is really kind of driving this conversation now is that, okay, if is 2024 going to start to kind of be a nice little upswing, maybe not be the best year we've ever had, but at least something that kind of helps make up a little bit of that difference that we lost last year. Yet to be seen. If it's anything like my colleagues and I are talking about, it's been a very slow first quarter, but the second quarter is looking like it's going to be gangbusters for a lot of people. It's going to be crazy busy, whether you're going out on the road and doing events like we are, or it's folks coming and visiting the Valley as well. The main causes, realistically, though, outside of just kind of the weird cycle of tourism that we experience, are probably a couple of things. I mean, one, it's expensive to get here. The hotels are outrageously expensive. Something that I think all of us are actually pretty upset about is that the cost of staying here in the Valley has gotten astronomically high from where it was not that long ago. And that's very, very frustrating. You have hotels that are, you know, gladly sitting at low occupancy rates, even though they could lower their prices and maybe get more business. It's kind of a weird phase. You know, we've also talked a lot about just the expense of Napa wine, you know, in terms of like the grape costs that we talked about and kind of how some of these things kind of trickle down to, you know, the consumers when these wines are made. Napa wine's only getting more expensive, and that can put a lot of people out as well. You have kind of this new shift in terms of demographics that are coming into, you know, their wine buying, and some that are leaving in terms of, you know, the baby boomer generation getting a little bit older, Gen Z being the young guns kind of coming into the fold officially. And there's some friction there between, you know, what these generations have purchased historically and those that are just finally able to afford something other than the cheapest beer in the liquor store, right? So there's a lot of moving and shifting that's kind of going on right now within the industry. It's going to be tough for people that didn't plan for this or have no idea how this operates in this sense. You can't necessarily plan for it exactly, other than being, I think, cautiously optimistic about how these years come and go. I think there are many, many businesses that have assumed, hey, we've had a couple great years back to back where we're growing by double digits. Let's do it all over again. And then 2023 hits and it just, you know, it falls very, very flat for some people. And now, you know, they've budgeted, I think, incorrectly and very aggressively. And that aggression in that planning is backfiring on them big time. And you're having a lot of people do some real soul searching in terms of, you know, you know, how things are going to shake down this year. It's kind of a mess for some people out there right now. And there are, you know, plenty of posts and blogs and podcasts out there saying like, you know, we just need these industries just need more support. You know, you need to visit Napa. You need to visit other, you know, wine countries within the U.S. You need to buy more wine. And it's like at a certain point, you can only ask people to do so much, you know, and you have to understand that if you as a business haven't set yourself up, you know, correctly, if you haven't planned, then you're planning to fail. You know, it's that old cliche. You need to have kind of these backup plans to make sure that you are, you know, doing right and you're not being overly aggressive. I've seen this happen with businesses that I've worked for where the planning is like, hey, we want not just double digit growth, but we want 20, 30% growth. All right, we didn't hit that goal. Well, now we didn't hit 20%, so we got to get, you know, 23% this year. Oops, didn't hit that. Now we got to get to, you know, 26% this year. And all of a sudden it's this snowball effect of like, oh, we're just always behind. And at a certain point you're like, well, I mean, is this actually a, you know, a valley-wide issue? Is this something that, you know, other people are struggling, or are we just not planning appropriately? And are we just being way too aggressive for what we're assuming can happen for us? So the causes of Napa being slower, I mean, between the price getting here, hotels, just the cost of getting to Napa, buying wines here, you know, dining out here, it's I think that's a big reason why it's slower. I also think that we are describing it as slower because I think many people have set their expectation way too high. And frankly, I think that's the fault of the wineries. You know, that really has nothing to do with you folks out there listening to the show or anyone else who's, you know, buying wine from Napa. There are a lot of wineries that are just assuming that, you know, this wine thing is kind of the goose that laid the golden egg, and they're not, I think they're being a little reckless with their planning and their projections. And it's hurting some people now at this stage. So it's a combination of many, many factors. It's a confluence of all these things going on. Is there like one silver bullet to fix it? Not really, unless we see just a huge influx of people coming to Napa again and having just a gangbusters year in terms of people visiting the valley. That's what would kind of completely right this ship, basically. I'm holding my breath because this first quarter has been so mellow. In fact, we're going to be on the road this year more than we ever have to get out and around the country. So we're trying to find creative ways to remedy this. Since people aren't coming here, we're trying to go to them. That's not necessarily what other folks are doing. It can also compete with your wholesale channels, with distributors and other things. And some of them can get a little upset about that if you're kind of selling wine in their backyard. So there's a lot of things to consider when it comes to this. And I'm not really sure, again, that there's like one great answer for it. You just have to figure out kind of which one of these things is really affecting your business and what might be the best order of operations to solve it realistically. I mean, any of us who have been in this industry for any period of time have seen this before. We're maybe not comfortable, but we understand that it's a phase and we'll get through it one way or the other. It's not that big of a deal. I mean, it can be, but if you're remotely good at planning and good at business and finance and budgeting and things, you should be okay. Should be fine. Question number two, and I like this one. This is a great, great question. It kind of ties together with this first question as well. Are you seeing any generational differences in wine consumers that are having an effect on the wine business? Absolutely not. This is something that I swear to God, this question comes up almost every 10 years. And I'll give you the background on why it does. And this happened with the millennial generation. This happened with Gen X. It's happening with Gen Z right now. So let's use Gen Z. We all love talking shit about them. So we'll use them as the scapegoat for this. They're also the ones that are going through this right now. And I can tell you that 10 years ago, I was going through the same thing. So to put some parameters around this, Gen Z, and I actually brought this up on my second monitor, so I actually can speak remotely intelligently about this generation. Gen Z was born between 1997 and 2012. That's kind of that 15-year range or so. And that means, right, that the oldest folks in that generation are 27. The youngest are 12. So there's a pretty big range of folks in this generation. And this is the conversation that everyone's having right now is, when is Gen Z going to start buying wine? How do we attract Gen Z? How do we market to them? What kind of wines are they buying? What are they into? What's meaningful to them? And you have, especially for the big producers, they're dumping all kinds of stuff at this and all kinds of money and market research and things to try and figure out, you know, how is this generation going to be different and how are we going to adapt and make sure we're selling to them? The same thing happened 10 years ago, 12 years ago with the millennials, myself. The question I got all the time working in a marketing department is like, what is important to your generation when it comes to buying products? And you know what my answer was 12 years ago? It's, I'm flat broke. I don't have money to spend just frivolously. You know, the disposable income I have is basically spent on walking to my local dive bar to have a shot and a beer after a long day and then going home and playing video games. Like, that was basically my life for probably way too long. And it simply was just because we didn't have the funds, the stability, that, you know, what we needed to live kind of the life that we were aiming for or wanted to, right? And Gen Z is right there. You figure some folks kind of in the older end of that spectrum that are getting into their late 20s, they're starting to establish careers, they're starting to establish families. All of us know how we were in our early 20s. The vast majority of us were complete shit shows. You know, you're still, you know, hanging on for dear life at that point, figuring out where you fit into this world. And if you're, you know, younger than 21, of course, your buying power is zero in terms of the wine industry. So realistically, what are we talking about here? You know, is it having an effect? Are they having an effect on the wine industry? Somewhat, because this is kind of that transitional period where you have this one generation that's supposed to be kind of supplanting someone from an older cohort, basically, and they're just not quite there yet. You also have a lot of Gen Z. I mean, their parents have, you know, they grew up with wine in and around them. They might know a little bit about it. You do have a segment of them, like other generations before them, that simply aren't into drinking alcohol. They're probably not going to be consuming the same way that some of us are. And that's true of any generation that came before them. I don't think that this is a unique conversation. Is it having an effect?
Hiring isn't just about finding someone willing to take the job. You need the right person with the right background who can move your business forward. If you want candidates who truly match what you're looking for, trust Indeed Sponsored Jobs. With Indeed Sponsored Jobs, your post stands out to quality candidates who actually fit the role. According to Indeed data, 90% are more likely to be hired and trusted by 1.6 million companies. Spend more time interviewing candidates who check all your boxes. Less stress, less time, more results. Now with Indeed Sponsored Jobs. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to help your job get the premium status it deserves at Indeed.com/podcast13. Just go to Indeed.com/podcast13 right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/podcast13. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Do it the right way with Indeed.
On the wine business? Potentially, but I think it's pretty nominal. And here's a couple of reasons that I think why. Number one, and actually this is a great one that someone brought up with me the other day. They're like, oh, you know, all these new generations, you have certain states and locales that have legalized cannabis. They're smoking weed more than they're drinking wine. And based on studies we've seen, and I think Wine Searcher, or maybe it was winebusiness.com, posted some statistics about this. That basically that's a non-issue currently, that those that have continued to, those that smoke weed and consume wine are doing both of those things. Those that do one or the other are doing one or the other. And of course, those that abstain are abstaining. It's pretty clean cut that that's not having an issue. There is also the question of like, oh, there's the assumption that Gen Z is specifically this generation is kind of steering themselves away from alcohol, that they're seeing it as a net negative in their life and they want nothing to do with it. And that upwards of 20% of this generation is going to not consume alcohol in any way, shape or form. What I haven't been able to track down actually, and finding statistics like this is really, really tough as it turns out, but between millennials, Gen X and boomers, like what was the proportion of those generations that don't drink either? And I don't think it, I mean, I don't think that it's going to be outside of kind of a margin of error, realistically, maybe a couple of percent one way or the other, but let's be real here. I don't think that that's going to be the biggest driving issue that this conversation faces. What I do think is the biggest issue is simply the population density. The amount of baby boomers that were born was roughly, I brought, how many was it? It was about 76.5 million were a part of that generation initially. Now it's less than, just based on folks crossing the Rainbow Bridge, less than 70 million. I think it's like closer to 65 or something like that. Again, finding statistics, I've searched like everything from census data to other research polls, and the numbers vary greatly. Like in this one, which is pewresearch.org, there are roughly 65.2 million. Oh, wait, sorry, that's Generation X. And 71.6, and then millennials have officially surpassed them in terms of their population, which, you know, millennials take up roughly 72 million or so people in the country. Boomers are basically at 71. And then you have Gen X, what was the other number from that? At about 65 million. So I think this is the bigger issue, based on kind of these numbers that I'm throwing around, is that the boomers being such a big generation, the Gen X generation being much smaller, and now the millennial generation being smaller, kind of at its start, That's where we're going to have a problem, because now you have to focus on one thing, and that is getting more people, a higher percentage of that generation, to consume something like wine and be into it. Whereas if you had, you know, let's just say you had 10%, you know, of, you know, boomers into wine, is higher than that. But let's just, for the sake of easy math, right, that means that 7.6 million people around the country would be drinking wine. At its height, if you have Gen X at 65 million, that means you have 6.5 million people, right? 10% of that. So you naturally have a million less people just into wine because of the percentage, right? So I think that's really the bigger conversation here, in the generational difference between how people are consuming wine, is that there are less people available to buy the wines that we're making. And I think this might be, I don't think that there's going to be necessarily like some bubble that bursts where it's like all of a sudden there's just so much wine to go around that we don't know what to do with it. But I think it's going to be kind of a, you know, it's going to deflate a little bit. You're not going to see this pop and this crash, but you're going to see businesses that are naturally already kind of struggling, that don't have a great, you know, don't have great market share and don't have a great, you know, customer base. They're slowly going to fall by the wayside because there's just not nearly as many people to backfill what they're trying to do. That's, I think, the real conversation that needs to be had here. As far as I can tell, across the board, these generational conversations every 10 to 12 years are basically us rehashing the same stuff that we've talked about for decades and decades and decades. It's, when is the new generation going to be into fine wine? When are they going to graduate from Two Buck Chuck and Bud Light, or insert cheap beverage here, and start buying something that is a higher price point, higher quality, and getting, hopefully, you know, more, you know, I'm trying to think of the right word, a complete brain fart, but work their way up kind of the price point scale to stuff that is a higher quality, and buy from places like Napa rather than, say, Lodi or Paso or something like that. That being said, the HBIC has been down in the Paso area, Santa Barbara, for the last week, basically, tasting through a bunch of wines, and you'd be shocked at how expensive wines from even outside of Napa are now in California, easily pushing 60, 70, 125 bucks a bottle, for stuff that it's, you can actually find some of those wines cheaper here, oddly enough, in terms of like the variety and style and whatnot. It's kind of crazy. So are you seeing any generational difference in wine consumers? No, I'm seeing the same issues, is that there's a certain, you know, cohort that's not ready for fine wine. They can't necessarily afford it. They might not understand it just yet, and they're trying to figure out where it fits into their life. And then you're seeing the millennials, Gen X, really do the heavy lifting right now in terms of wine consumption, as you might expect. And as those in the baby boomer generation continue to get older, potentially consume less alcohol, or unfortunately cross the rainbow bridge, obviously wine consumption is going to go down. So it's, in my mind, this is history repeating. Am I worried about it? No. Am I keeping an eye on it? Absolutely yes, because you'd be foolish not to. You know, if you're owning a business and you don't know where your next sale is going to be coming from, and you don't take these kind of broad trends into account, you're really setting yourself up for some pain there. So it is really, really worth to ask that questions like this, but also not freak out at the same time. Because if it's not broke, don't fix it. But also be proactive. Don't be afraid of throwing things at the wall to see if it sticks, to attract new customers, right? That is the way to go, no doubt about it. It's so funny seeing that question come back up, because no joke, this was something that we had meeting after meeting after meeting 10, 12 years ago. It was just, this was everybody's focus, and everyone was so obsessed with it. And realistically, I don't know if anything we did ever had an effect. It was just a matter of time before people were like, hey, I'm entertaining clients. I need to know something about wine. I don't need to know a lot about wine. What do I need to know? Maybe I need to go to Napa to experience some of this and understand it. And you slowly kind of, people start to figure out where something like wine as a luxury consumer good fits into their life, whether it's on a daily, weekly, monthly basis or not at all. And that takes time. And those people that are looking for these big growth numbers and really wanting to attack, you know, the next consumer base are probably having a little bit of a hard time with it, as they normally do. When realistically, I think there's a lot more you can do in the background to, you know, solve kind of what this generational work through this generational shift that we're starting to see now. All right. Oh, this is another good one because of last week's episode. For those that didn't catch it, we talked about whether or not wine consultants are ruining the wine industry, and particularly how that's affected Napa over the last few decades. I'd highly recommend checking that out if you haven't had the chance. And this is in reference to that. So if you didn't catch it, we'll kind of dive into it here to give you a little bit of detail and background into it, but it's worth checking out that entire episode to kind of get a bird's eye view of where things are at and how that this conversation has come to be. So what is the solution to Napa's homogenization? Is there one? And this is in reference to, sorry, I keep having this frog in my throat. It's like cold, it's rainy today. I'm all bundled up. I'm still sipping on my nice warm cup of coffee to help settle things out. I'm mostly awake at this point. So the solution to Napa's homogenization, is there one? Yes, it's a very easy answer, actually. Because, and this is something, you know, just to kind of loop this into last week's conversation, very typically there are, well, not very typically, but there are a lot of winemakers that are, there are a handful of winemakers, I should say, a handful of winemakers making a lot of wine in this valley. They have multiple clients, many of them very, very high end, some of them a little bit more casual. And the issue is that because of this small group of people making a huge amount of the wine here, or at least having a hand in it, you're seeing a lot of these wines homogenize. Obviously, you have kind of the same team working on them no matter what. The great counter argument to this, and I do think you need to take this into account, is that most wineries do have someone on site that handles the day-to-day. Some of these consultants don't just jump in, they don't work there full time. They pop in and out for blending sessions during harvest. They're just kind of there in the periphery, making sure things are going the way they want. But they do make selections in terms of how those grapes are being processed, when they're being picked, you know, what barrels are being used, what the aging time is, and of course what those final blends end up being. And it's no surprise that you can find similarities between, you know, the same consultant making wine for multiple different people. Now, you're hopefully going to find some differences as well. You want all those wines to be unique and kind of show the terroir, as we call it, the combination of land, climate, winemaking, grape selection, and so on, that kind of encompass everything that goes into making a bottle of wine. And I think the easy answer to this is you rely more on that. You rely more on the terroir. You say, hey, I know I typically like this set of barrels. And for the producers that I work with as a consultant, you say, hey, you know, and this is true story. This is how I operate, actually, with any time I'm doing a private label or making wine for other folks, is I have barrels that I know I love. Those might not be the right choice for the wine I'm trying to make for somebody else. Now, there'll probably be a few that stick, that there certainly have been with certain clients, where it's like, hey, these barrels for what you're trying to achieve stylistically, what you really enjoy, this is, you know, I already work with these folks. It's going to be an easy way to kind of dive in and make some really great wine kind of at the drop of the hat, right? I'm also very proactive in saying, okay, here's kind of the characteristics of this wine. And this is what I do as soon as I pick up a new client, is that if they've made wine before, I go through and I taste it. If they have stuff in barrel, I go through, I taste it. And I start kind of formulating in my head, okay, outside of my normal realm of cooperages that I use, but ones that I'm familiar with because maybe I've used them in the past, or maybe I've had barrel samples through just being in the industry and chatting with people about them, or their sales rep has dropped off wine for me to try and sell me more barrels. I'm like, yeah, maybe that doesn't work for my project, but for yours, this is the way we want to go. We need to spice this up in a way that it's going to be really, really interesting. And that trickles on down even, you know, further back into how we're processing those grapes, when we're harvesting, and what we're trying to achieve, and really what we're trying to represent. And I think any consultant works in this way. There are certainly some that we know of that have a little bit more of the cookie cutter. We make wine by this recipe. We're looking for XYZ numbers and they need to be within this range. By the way, you need to buy these barrels if we're going to make this wine. And it's a little bit more finite. And I think that's the big issue and why Napa has homogenized over the last couple of decades is because it became a little bit more cookie cutter. And yes, they're trying to capture what this, you know, other winery in this terroir is, but if they're using a lot of the same techniques, kind of willy-nilly, if they're using a lot of the same barrels without really considering, hey, what else is out there that we could potentially use, it's going to start putting a box around a lot of these wines, right? If you're using the same barrels across 30 different producers, you're going to have a lot of similarities between those producers. That shouldn't be that hard to figure out. So I think it behooves consultants and just winemakers in general, whether you're making wine for yourself or for other people, or you're in this consulting world, that you try to find certain things about that producer that's going to make it unique and stand out from everybody else you're working with, including maybe your own wines. That's something that is outrageously important. And I think it's just my gut reaction that many people kind of got away from this because they're like, oh, they're hiring me. This is how I make wine. So those are the procedures we're going to implement. And there is some truth to that. If you're consulting as a winemaker, you kind of want to have your like stamp of approval. You want people to know that you had a hand in that wine. I'm thoroughly of the opinion, though, that you can't go too far. This is not your wine project. You're the hired gun trying to do right by these other people. That's the approach you need to take. So the solution is take that step back, understand that you're not necessarily making your wine, you're making somebody else's. And this is making it sound like everybody's got like this, you know, snobby attitude of like, oh, you're hiring me, therefore we're making wine like this, and kind of being dicks about it. That's really not how it is, but I think Napa just kind of in general over the last 10, 15 years has kind of, you know, not been able to see the forest through the trees. And there are far too many wines that are just far too similar right now. And when it comes down to like buying and price point, and this is what we talked about in last week's episode, is that if one of those wines is $600 a bottle, but there's another one that's $200 or maybe $95, and they're all solid, made by the same winemaker, I mean, which one are you going to buy, right? Like if you can save $500, why not buy the one that's still really good? Maybe it's not, you know, hopefully there's a difference. There should be, right? But I mean, why spend the extra money, right? Like that's the bigger issue, is that if you have so few people making so many wines and there's this giant range to these price points and the wines are all pretty similar, like why are you buying the expensive stuff? You can buy stuff that's just as good. That's a much more of a value buy in that situation. So I think this is an easy problem to fix just by being a little bit more self-aware of your techniques, how you're operating. And that's it. It's really, really straightforward. I'm pretty firmly of the opinion, though, that there's going to be a lot of people who just ignore this and they say, oh, this is not an issue. You know, this is fine. This is just how I do things, and kind of brush this off and shrug this off. And frankly, I think they're going to shoot themselves in the foot. If I had a crystal ball, that's what I'd be looking at, in my opinion. All right. God, last week's episode, there's a little heat that's come after that one. It's been fun. It's been well worth it, though. Well worth it. All righty. We got question number 4. This is actually in reference because we've been mentioning some of the events that we have going on around the country. So this is kind of one of those, you know, how do you organize that kind of stuff? So when you're traveling for wine, how do you end up in these cities and promoting or producing these events? Honestly, so, I'm throwing things. That's my bad. I always have to have something to fiddle with. Many of you have seen this. If you're sitting with me like in the cave or at events, I typically have like a wine key in my hand. And this time I have a Sharpie. I just need something to like fiddle with. It helps like keep me like relaxed a little bit. Anyway, when you travel for wine, how do you end up in these cities and producing these events? Honestly, the way it started for us, and it's a little different for I think everybody, but it's kind of, you're trying to find hubs of where you have like a decent following. So for us, there are certain states and certain cities that, you know, people are big MTGA fans. And we know that if we send out invites to, you know, this locale, that we can get 30, 40, 60 or more people in a room and say, hey, we're going to do a wine tasting. It could be where we have distributor contacts, where they're, you know, allowing us to come in and we're working the market with them to try and get wine placements in local restaurants and shops. It could also be a surrounding kind of more charitable causes. Britt is going out to Côte d'Or this year out in Dallas, or I think it's actually out in Frisco. Maybe it's in Dallas. I can't remember. Somewhere in the greater Dallas area. And then I'm going to be out in Kansas City for Shuttlecork this year. We'll both be back in Napa for Collective Napa Valley with the Vintners. You know, there are certain things kind of throughout the year where we are, you know, helping support some of these more charitable efforts. And it's like, hey, if we're in town and we know we have kind of clients in and around this area, let's send out a note and say, hey, we're in town. Does anyone want to get together for dinner? You know, put together an event of some sort. How do we, you know, go about doing this stuff? We do have to be very cautious. You know, there are a lot of different rules and regulations and legislation and things involved when it comes to doing wine events around the country. So it's, that's all stuff that we kind of have to, you know, also be very cognizant of, because we don't want to piss anybody off. We don't want to be found and not being in compliance in some way, shape, or form, because we can lose our license. So there's a lot of hoops to jump through, but it's pretty easy to sort through some of that information or get in touch with that government agency, that liquor control board or whatever, and figure out like what we need to put on an event and go from there. So these events largely get put together because we have, you know, something going on in that area, or some charitable event, or a bunch of club members or fans kind of in an area. And then what we try and do is we just pull a list of, you know, folks that we know in that, you know, in those zip codes and be like, hey, we're going to be within, you know, 60 or 100 miles of you. If you're looking for a little something to do on this night, here's what we got going on. And we go from there. So it's kind of a pain because of like the legalities of putting it all together and just kind of the logistics. But once it's set up, we do all that on our end and kind of on the back end. So it's stuff that you typically don't have to worry about. And we just let it rip. We just go from there. It's a lot of fun because of the, it's something that we started doing very early on. Actually, you know, probably like 6-7 years into winemaking and getting our wines out and about. And it was great to go around the country and visit with people and get to know them a little better and share our wines with a broader audience. And that's something that has worked very, very well for us. And it's something that continues to work very, very well for us. It's why this spring is going to be so busy for Britt and I. We're going to be on the road a lot over the course of the next 3 months. The second quarter is going to be bonkers. So we're going to be ships passing in the night at some point. I think I'm in the state of Missouri for like 3 weeks or something ridiculous between April and May. It's going to be wild. I'm going to stock up on a lot of good barbecue, though, that's for sure. Get some good beers, get some good barbecue, you know, change things up a little bit since we're just going to be slinging wine all day, every day. I think we're pretty much right up against it here. Yeah, we're almost, 37 minutes. We're going to save the next question for next time. So we'll have another round of questions at the end of April, of course. So thank you all so much for tuning in. It has been a really interesting few weeks diving into kind of the nooks and crannies of the wine business, from the grape price conversation to how, you know, consultants are impacting the wine industry. It's been, you might not believe this just listening to it as like maybe a more casual wine fan or just kind of learning about the wine industry, but those topics are some of the most hot button topics in the industry. It's very interesting when we get together with other colleagues and we talk about these things, because it's stuff that's just absolutely, absolutely bonkers. And it's, we all perk up and we all kind of sit up a little straighter and we have these very serious, very intense conversations about these things. And, I think it's very interesting to share some of this with you all and, you know, give you a little bit of like this inside baseball mentality of like, here's what those of us like that own and run wine businesses, this is the stuff that is, that we're worried about, that we're trying to sort out, that kind of the things that are, you know, getting our gears going and figuring out like, how do we adapt to this kind of ever-changing wine marketplace. You know, the last month and a half have been some of my favorite episodes to do, because this is the stuff like at the heart of the industry, like the driving forces that we're working with, against, through, all that stuff. So I hope you found some insightful information and some fun stuff that you've enjoyed from kind of this more business aspect side of things. As we kick off the month of April, I've been talking for a long, long time about getting guests on the show. We are going to be doing that in April. We finally have the location down. I've got, I think, the equipment that I need. It's probably going to be a little weird at first as we kind of do our rough, you know, we've done some trial runs, but there's nothing like actually sitting down and doing it. So we're going to try and get that done and finally have some other folks on the show so you all can listen to not just me, but other folks within the industry that have some really great insights, some really great opinions as far as, you know, where things are going, how things are, and how this wine industry is like ebbing and flowing here in Napa. It's going to be some really fun conversations coming up throughout the rest of the year. It's my goal to have at least one guest a month. Hopefully we'll be able to do more of that, you know, as we can schedule more people and record a few of them and get things rolling. So thank you all so much for the immense support. Reminder, check out our website for our events in Kansas City and St. Louis. With Chicago, we do have a wait list going, as well as Dallas, we do have a wait list going. So you can email us, head to our, submit a little request through our website. That's mtjwines.com. We can get you on those wait lists. Be sure again to rate, review, share the podcast with anyone who may be wine inclined. And you can follow us on all of our social networks at MTJ Wines. That's YouTube, Book of Face, Instagram, and the social network formerly known as Twitter. Thank you so much for tuning in. Oh, one last thing. For those of you that have questions about the wine industry that you're curious about and would like to have something featured on this Q&A episode at the end of every month, leave comments on any of our social media posts, any of our videos on YouTube, slide into our DMs, and we have basically a running document and list of stuff that we've covered through all of these. So if you would like to, if you have things that you want to know more about, we'll dive right into it. We're definitely getting a lot of more questions in terms of the wine production side of things. So next month, it's probably going to be a little bit more wine production focused. We've been really diving into kind of like the dollars and cents and business stuff over the last month and a half. So we're probably going to shift back and do a little bit more of kind of the geeky winemaking, you know, why our hands are purple during harvest and all that kind of stuff. So thanks all so much. We'll catch you later. Have an amazing rest of the week. Cheers.
Hiring isn't just about finding someone willing to take the job. You need the right person with the right background who can move your business forward. If you want candidates who truly match what you're looking for, trust Indeed Sponsored Jobs. With Indeed Sponsored Jobs, your post stands out to quality candidates who actually fit the role. According to Indeed data, 90% are more likely to be hired and trusted by 1.6 million companies. Spend more time interviewing candidates who check all your boxes. Less stress, less time, more results. Now with Indeed Sponsored Jobs. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to help your job get the premium status it deserves at Indeed.com/podcast13. Just go to Indeed.com/podcast13 right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/podcast13. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Do it the right way with Indeed.